and good Monday morning to you. I'm Renee Bodley with Mountain Money. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk to the CEO of Proterra. That's the company that made Park City's new electric buses. I bet a bunch of you saw those this weekend zipping up and down 224. You heard from Ryan Popple. He's the CEO. At the top of the local news hour, Leslie Thatcher had a couple sound bites from him from Friday's ribbon cutting. Popple will have an update on how the first weekend went with the new buses and why this project in particular was especially important to him. Then we'll have Vanessa Chapman and Chelsea Anderson in studio. They're going to talk about Main Street Social. That's a new restaurant on Heber's Main Street. You've probably seen it as you've driven through Heber. It's the historic house at the corner of Main Street and 100 South. Other restaurants have been there in the past. We'll hear from these new owners about their plans for the space. And first, though, we're going to kick off the hour with author Robert Bruce Shaw. He wrote a new book called Extreme Teams. He examined how innovative companies like Airbnb, Netflix, Pixar, and Patagonia used a new model of teamwork to ensure their success. We can all learn a little something from him, I think, in this book. That's all coming up on Mountain Money this next hour. And joining me in studio, Doug Wells, my co-host, is on vacation, and our producer, Bob Hendricks. He's always behind the board. He's a great guy joining us this morning. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Thank you. Our weather, isolated showers and thunderstorms after 1 this afternoon, mostly sunny with a high near 86. Going to be warm today. And then something unusual in the forecast, smoke in the forecast for tonight and tomorrow. Must be smoke moving in from Brian Head, only for just a couple of days. And then the wind must kind of switch around. So just smoke for tonight and tomorrow. But again, 86 today, 70s for the rest of the week. We're at 59 degrees here in Old Town, and we'll be right back with more in just a moment.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley, the new co-host of Mountain Money, taking the place of Larry Warren, our beloved GM. He left us last week. I'm the new general manager and the new co-host. Doug Wells is on vacation. I'm in studio with Bob Hendricks, our producer and program director here at KPCW. Our first guest this morning is the author Robert Bruce Shaw. He wrote the book Extreme Teams. It's the latest of many books he's written, including Trust in the Balance, Building Successful Organizations on Results, Integrity, and Concern. Another book is Leadership Blind Spots. Shaw holds a PhD in organizational behavior from Yale University. He helps business leaders build organizations and teams for superior performance. He's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
How are you?
I'm very well.
Good. And in your book, it's really interesting. You talk about the following companies: Whole Foods, Pixar, Zappos, Alibaba, Netflix, Patagonia. Tell us why you picked those companies in particular.
Two factors I look for. One, I wanted them to be successful firms that have a track record of growth. And the second, I wanted them to be known for their innovation, particularly around management, trying new approaches, overturning the status quo where appropriate. And each of those seven companies fit the bill on both of those factors.
Now, at least most of those companies, the Whole Foods, Pixar, Zappos, they're different from your traditional competitor in those genres. So it's sort of disruptive economies, and they're innovative just by who they are, the definition of what they do. So they kind of needed to find a different management model, didn't they?
Well, it's a great insight on your part in that these firms are all disruptive. If you take Netflix and what it's done in its industry or Airbnb, each of them has overturned the status quo. But the key theme in the book is they also overturned the status quo in terms of how they manage their companies. And the one key takeaway is that innovation is critically important, not only in terms of products and offerings, but in terms of how you structure and manage companies, in particular how you use teams. And these companies are exemplars in that regard.
So for our listeners, we have a Whole Foods here and we have a Patagonia here. Can you give us specific examples about how those two companies use extreme teams?
Well, let's start with Whole Foods. It's one of the most team-based companies in the world. And one of the examples I give of that in the book is when you're hired at Whole Foods, you're on a probationary period for 2 to 3 months. And at the end of that period, the team decides whether you stay or go. Not your supervisor, not more senior management, but the team. And then you need two-thirds of the team to support you before you're retained as a full-time team member. You don't find that in many companies. And that's just one example of the many things they do to support teams. In terms of Patagonia, it is one of the most purpose-driven companies in the world. And it invests in the culture of the company in ways that you just don't see. For example, people have complete autonomy in terms of when they work and, as they say in Patagonia, when they play. And it's an outdoor clothing company, as you know. And if you want to go surfing in the middle of the day, you can do that. You're expected to come back and complete your work. But they give you the ability to determine what hours you're going to work.
So how do you know if your organization is the right one for this team concept?
It's part of it, you have to look at your broader culture and what the business requires. This isn't done just because you believe teams are important, but what's required for the group to be successful. For example, at Whole Foods, there are really 7-8 businesses within each Whole Foods that run different departments such as produce or meat. So you start with the business. Then you have to look at your culture and say, can you support these teams? Because if you don't have the larger cultural systems and processes in place, it's very hard for these teams to thrive. So those are the two factors I look at, and it also always goes back to the senior leadership of the company and whether they believe in this. And if you look at the 7 companies that I profile, each of them is led by a charismatic founder who believed in this and wanted to work in a company that had this type of culture.
So, Robert, this is Bob Hendricks asking a question. How do you build a good team? How do you know that you've built a team now that's going to be fair, that's going to be, there's not going to be backbiting, there's not going to be problems within that team?
Well, one of the things I write about in the book is what I call this hard, soft culture. And if you look at these companies, and they vary in terms of how they approach this, but the best teams have a combination of a soft, community-like structure where people are supportive and trusting, and there are a number of factors that go into that. But they also have a hard culture in terms of metrics, performance expectations, peer pressure. And the best companies push both of those. They push the hard part of the culture, and there are examples throughout my book of this for companies like Pixar. But they also push the community-like aspects. In most firms, it's one or the other. Either they bias towards the hard or they bias towards the soft.
Well, I notice when you talk about culture, and these companies are about culture, and how a fit is more important for an employee than that employee's actual experience when you're looking to have someone join the team. It seems to me this is a significant shift in corporate thinking. Instead of that traditional ladder that companies depend on, where you come in at one level, you spend a few years there, you get the experience, you move up to the next level, it's possible under this extreme team setup that someone with a great deal of experience could be out of a good job or not be eligible for a good job simply because their personality doesn't fit with the team. Is there a downside to that?
There's a downside if it's used as a way of selecting only people who look and think like yourself. So you have to be careful that it's not used just to screen people who may be different in terms of their thought process or background or the like. But what you find in these companies is they pay a great deal of attention to culture, and they want people who fit the culture. It's not so much personality as it is your set of values and what you believe is important, and particularly do you feel passionately about the either the team or the company's purpose. And I'll give you an example to your point about you could be out of a job. At Zappos, they tell the story, they hired a CFO who was highly qualified, and it took them over a year to find this individual, key role and the like, and they have a mandatory training program at the beginning of each employee's hire, and that's to talk about the culture, what's important. Well, this individual thought he was above that and skipped the sessions, and he was given a feedback that he needed to attend those. He skipped the second session, and they fired him.
Oh.
And so part of this is it's easy to talk about culture, but when you truly embrace it, people who either don't fit the culture aren't hired, or if they violate the cultural norms, they're asked to leave.
Let me go back to something you said a few moments ago, that the group determines who stays and who goes. Is there somebody above them that can override that decision?
In Whole Foods, the team vote is the end decision-making process. So So no, in that case, not. In other companies, they have hybrids. For example, a lot of companies will use 360 feedback, and some even include it in their performance appraisals. So there are different versions of this. And one of the things I want to emphasize is that each company needs to find its own way in terms of these extreme teams. There are examples that I provide throughout the book, and there's some guidelines, some factors that you find. But you have to look at your own culture and determine how aggressive you want to be on each of these dimensions. So it varies by company. In the case of Whole Foods, it's the team that decides.
So when I was reading this book, I had to cringe a little bit when I thought about a team making a decision on whether someone stays or goes. And maybe this is what you're referring to when you say hard and soft culture. To me, I thought, oh gosh, this could be an HR nightmare if a team decides to vote somebody out and they don't have the right documentation, the right criteria, that they didn't go through those hard metrics appropriately. Have you seen teams stumble on that?
Well, what you find in more conventional companies is that the HR guidelines become limiting, and it's very difficult to either use a process such as this, or even it later, and not necessarily team-based, but they decide someone's not a good fit and they want to remove them from the company. If you look at a company like Netflix, it's one of the most creative and bold companies I know in terms of overturning standard HR practices. And some of this you have to determine what's fair. I'm not advocating anything that treats employees unfairly, but not be bound by conventional practices. And it's easy to default to those, but the best companies don't. They determine what they want to achieve and then make it happen. Let me give you an example from Netflix. One of the things Netflix believes, and it's a relatively small company, but they believe if you perform at an average level, you're going to be asked to leave. And the way they phrase this is average performance results in a generous severance. And what they do is they write a significant check to the people they want to leave. Now, most companies won't do that. They'll put you on a performance improvement plan, provide coaching and the like. Netflix doesn't do that. It basically gives you an opportunity, and at a reasonable point in time, if they determine you're not going to perform at their level, then you leave. And they've done this with hundreds and hundreds of people over the course of their history.
Gosh,
most HR leaders wouldn't support that.
Yeah, how do you prevent someone from saying, I'm going to get hired by Netflix and then get fired and get a good severance check?
Well, they have a pretty good feel for why people are coming.
Yeah.
And most people, they're not looking for that. They're looking to stay with the company and the like. And also they think of their own careers. Now, if you leave Netflix, it's not a black mark against you in terms of that the people know that culture. But at the same time, that's not a major problem for them.
And it seems to me another important criteria to establish an extreme team is that you need to be a company that has a mission statement that inspires passion in its employees, that is beyond, we're here to make a profit.
It's one of the things you find in these companies, they're incredibly profitable. But profit's not the primary driver. And for a lot of companies, companies that I work with as a consultant alike, they would find that to be an absurd statement. But the way these companies think is we're here for a larger purpose, which is easy to say and harder to do.
Yeah.
But they truly believe that. And you can go through each of the seven companies and look at that. If you take Alibaba, for example, it's probably going to be the first trillion-dollar company. And its mission is to support small businesses and make them successful. And it looks at every decision it makes and says, how can we best support small businesses? They're not oblivious to the need for profit, but that's not the primary driver.
And that was the one company I was least familiar with in your book. Can you explain to our listeners what Alibaba is?
It's a Chinese-based internet company that in some ways is similar to Amazon, but it doesn't stock goods. It's more of a conduit for businesses to supply their goods across the globe, and primarily in China, but it's now expanded globally. And it also provides a host of auxiliary services to small businesses, such as financing, advertising, logistics, and it's on a rapid growth trajectory. It's been very successful and has an extremely charismatic founder in Jack Ma. And if people are interested, you can look at my book or there are other books written about Alibaba that are worth exploring.
And this is a little bit off topic, but because Whole Foods is a big part of your book, what do you make of Amazon buying Whole Foods? Any insight there?
Well, one of the things I noted in the book is that teams are critically important, but they don't guarantee success. And I'm an advocate for these types of teams, but you also have a competitive landscape, and you have to have strategies. In the case of Whole Foods, they have a number of competitors that have come in part because of Whole Foods' success, such as Kroger and Walmart and so on. So I'm actually excited about Amazon assuming control. Amazon also owns Zappos, which is one of the companies I profile in the book. And it'll be interesting to see what Amazon does with Whole Foods in terms of how aggressive it is in changing that culture, and in particular my area, how they use the teams in that company.
Another subject you tackle in the book is conflict within teams. What is the best way to manage conflict in a team?
Well, in most companies, conflict is avoided. It's at least the companies that I work with, and it's seen as a sign of failure. So if you go into a meeting and there's aggressive conflict, often it's the fault of either one party or another, or histories that people have with each other that aren't particularly productive. In these companies, they embrace conflict. And probably my favorite example is Pixar, which has a number of processes in place to promote and manage conflict. So, for example, one of they use is called the dailies. So if you're on one of their film teams, each day in the morning you go over the work of one of the team members of the past week or two. And it's a critical review. It's basically you didn't get this right, or this could be changed, or you have to redo this. And they build that in because it results in better films. And they have other mechanisms they use at various levels to promote conflict. And I'm not saying conflict done unskillfully is something you want, but the worst thing you can do is avoid it, which is often what you find in many companies.
One of your bullet points is take comfort in discomfort, and that's what we're talking about right now. How do you take someone who's very creative and maybe a little soft-skinned and do this and have them want to stay with the company?
It can be hard. I think particularly if you're talking about creative endeavors, and you can imagine if you're a director at Pixar or you're an animator and someone's looking at your work and saying, it's not very good, and here's why. It's not just saying it's bad, but it's not good and how to improve it. So there are a couple things you can do, and I'm not minimizing the challenge in this. But one is you try to make the conflict about the product or the business, not about the individual. So the best you can, you depersonalize it. And the second thing you do is you require that there's some constructive element to it. So if you're criticizing in the dailies I mentioned earlier, what would you do to improve it? It doesn't mean the person has to take that recommendation, but it's not just being critical. And so part of it is, can you develop a culture that allows for this without damaging the relationships and the motivation of people to continue?
Now, you also mentioned, going back to company culture, you included Patagonia has an on-site daycare, not because it's cost-effective necessarily, but because it's the right thing to do and to give the employees the feeling that they're working for a company that cares about them and their family situation. But you also talk about there's a risk of companies treating employees like family. What are those risks?
Well, the main one is with a family that becomes either too polite, I'm not going to say things to you that need to be said because I don't want to hurt your feelings or damage our relationship, or you won't make the tough calls. For example, if someone's underperforming and they need to be removed, there's not many families where you'd fire your uncle or your aunt or the like, but in companies that happens. And if you go back to Pixar, it has one of the most family-like environments, but they've fired a number of their directors midstream after giving them ample time. But if they feel like the director and his or her team can't deliver, they'll be fired. And typically they're offered a role within the company, and many don't stay. But it's that combination. So the family-like environment is critical, but if you take it too far, it becomes an inhibitor of performance.
And sometimes an employee's passion for their work can get in the way of their family. And Pixar, you mentioned an example where an employee was so jazzed about going to work, he goes to work and forgets he has a young child in the back of his car. Fortunately, he realized it in time, and there was no harm done to the child. But there is a risk sometimes when you're too enthusiastic about your job.
Absolutely. It's one of the things I'm most interested in is this notion of obsession. And if you look at that example, which is a wonderful one, fortunately not a tragic one, the animator was so consumed with the film he was working on, he had forgotten that he was supposed to go to daycare and drop off the child. It was only when his wife called and said, how was the drop-off, he remembered that the child was in the back seat. Pixar then took a look at itself and saying, perhaps we're pushing too hard, too fast, and we need to back off a bit, which they put some things in place to make that less likely. The thing I'd say, though, is if you don't have that passion or what I call obsession, then typically you don't produce great things. So the question is, how far can you push it without the damage like we just talked about with Pixar?
Let me ask, just going way back, you're approaching Pixar and Netflix or Airbnb, and you're saying, here's what I'm going to do for your company. Is there kind of a warning that this is not going to be pretty or easy or it's going to be ugly? What's that first approach that you have for them?
Well, to your earlier question, part of it is assessing whether the culture can support these kind of teams. And in some cases, it's better not to move towards these types of teams if the culture is so conventional and so risk-averse that it won't push forward. What you find in these companies is they try a number of things, and some of them don't work in terms of teams, either in terms of performance reviews or in terms of training, a whole myriad of things that they experiment with, and they keep what works and leave behind that which doesn't. So teams are now popular, but, and this is somewhat of an ironic statement for me, but they're often overused because they're not designed well, they're not supported effectively. So part of it is you have to do a gut check and say, am I truly willing to support these types of teams? And that doesn't mean carte blanche or you're willing to tolerate things that are unacceptable, but you have to have that level of commitment to make them work.
These companies all have thousands of employees. Pixar has 1,200 employees, Whole Foods 86,000. Can you have an extreme team in a company of less than 20 people?
Yes. In fact, if you look at many of these companies, they started with extreme teams. If you look at Netflix at its founding, Pixar started with a very small team. That's the genesis, Airbnb, three founders. So typically what you find are these are the teams that grow these firms initially, these types of teams. And then the question is, can you inculcate that in a larger culture? In Whole Foods' case, thousands and thousands of employees. So it's not so much a small company, it's the large company that's the challenge. And how do you architect that within a company of that size?
And we have just a few minutes left here. You've got a key set of questions that leaders of new teams need to ask before they create an extreme team. Can you bullet point those for us?
Well, the primary thing for me is what does the team need to achieve and be very clear about what success looks like for the team. And once that goal is articulated, and sometimes it's articulated by the leader or often with the team, but then what type of team is required? So the form of the team follows the goal that it's trying to achieve. And many people use teams for the sake that they like the concept of teams. So that's the key one. And then a second that's critically important is who's on the team. And some leaders try to use these types of teams with people who just are not prepared for them. And you mentioned earlier comfort with conflict. If you have the majority of the team is uncomfortable with conflict, you're going to have a tough time using some of the techniques that I talk about in the book. And then the third would be, how do you create that hard, soft culture? What's the combination of hard and soft that you need in your team to make it work? And around all of that is an entrepreneurial attitude, which is, this is important. I'm going to experiment with it and determine what can be successful in my particular setting.
We are talking to author Robert Bruce Shaw, the author of Extreme Teams. This has been a great interview. Anything else you want to add before we close out here that you want our listeners to know about your book?
Well, the thing I would emphasize, and this is actually a surprise to me as I examine these teams, is how exciting they are. Often we don't think of teams as exciting or highly motivating, but when you go into these companies, they're truly exciting places to work and sometimes even exhausting places to work. But that's the thing I think that is incredibly seductive about this, is it gives people a sense of motivation and purpose that you don't find in many more conventional firms that I've often worked with.
Good way to end it. Thank you very much. Robert Bruce Shaw, author of Extreme Teams. It's been wonderful having you on this morning.
Thank you. Pleasure talking with you.
We will.
All Resort Group is a proud KPCW sponsor of Mountain Money.
All Resort Group provides vans, SUVs, sedans, and Express for Less taxi to move you from Salt Lake to Park City and back, or anywhere you want to go.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch Counties.
And welcome back to Mountain Money here on KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley, the new co-host of Mountain Money, and Doug Wells is on vacation. I'm in studio here with Bob Hendricks. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
We've got a notice here from Summit County Council. They're hosting a work session and open house this week to discuss what's known as the Klein-Dolly property. This is the 30 acres the county purchased near Jeremy Ranch Elementary School for $3.7 million to build a transit-oriented development, or TOD. The Summit County Council will discuss the proposed parameters of the development in the work session on Wednesday. That's from 2 to 4 in the afternoon at the Sheldon Richens Building Auditorium at Kimball Junction. The open house, then, will be held from 4:15 to 6:30 at Jeremy Ranch Elementary School. A lot of people who drive up and down Rasmussen Road, obviously a lot of parents dropping off kids at the elementary school. And if there's a transit-oriented development there on those 30 acres, that obviously is going to increase traffic. So that's they're interested in getting residents' input on that. Once again, work session Wednesday from 2 to 4 in the afternoon at Sheldon Richens Building, then an open house that same day, Wednesday, from 4:15 to 6:30 p.m. at Jeremy Ranch Elementary School. We got some weather you want to recap?
Our weather forecast, isolated showers and thunderstorms after 1 today, mostly sunny with a high near 86. Going to be warm today. Chance of precipitation is 20%. And then they're talking about smoke in the area. Must be from the fire. Isolated thunderstorms tonight and partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 79. So a little warm today, cooling off a bit for tomorrow and for the rest of the week.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We have some guests that just haven't showed up yet this morning, so let's talk about that fire just for a moment. 70,000, was it last? 70,000 acres have burned in this fire. It started by someone burning weeds with a propane torch.
Yeah, this is the one down in Bryanhead.
It is. And I heard Leslie ask this morning, are they going to prosecute this guy? And they said, we don't know, but perhaps they should. So,
yeah.
You know, and it's up to, I think, somebody over $4 or $5 million now in cost to fight this fire. So you just would just wipe somebody out, I would suppose. They would have absolutely nothing left by the time they prosecuted something like this.
And there is a state law that if someone is found guilty of starting a fire, that the state fire marshal's office, does an investigation. They work with the county attorney, the county in which the fire started. They work with the U.S. Forest Service if it affects U.S. Forest Service lands. And, you know, it might be either that person personally is responsible for it, or it could be their insurance company that's responsible for it. But it's something to keep in mind when it's this hot and dry out there. And people love to go ATVing, UTVing. It's a lot of fun. And that area in Wasatch County above Soldier Hollow this weekend on, it was Friday afternoon, about 3 o'clock, an ATV crashed. And fortunately, no one injured that was reported, but it sparked a fire. And it ended up burning probably about 20 or 30 acres. And there was an update from Wasatch County Fire on that. This was yesterday afternoon that the fire is 100% contained, and Cascade Springs Road was expected to be open by 6 p.m. last night. There were going to be some crews and trucks in the area for a few days mopping up the hot spots. So if winds stay low, Bob, and they can mop up those hot spots, then we should be safe. That was kind of the area of the Wheeler Fire about 2 years ago above Soldier Hollow. Then there's another fire in Wasatch County, the Beaver Fire. And this was an update that was from yesterday afternoon, so we need to get an update on this. But 43 acres have burned. This is near Strawberry Reservoir. Four outbuildings burned and one RV burned up there. And there are four structures threatened. Two helicopters, two hotshot crews, and three Type 6 engines at the scene. I'm sorry, I don't know what Type 6 engine means. Fire is 20% contained. It's burning on a hillside that has beetle-killed timber on it. And, man, you know that's going to ignite quickly.
It is, yes. Maybe a Type 6 engine is just a little bit larger than a Type 5.
And a little smaller than a Type 7, I'm guessing.
Could be, that's right. Yeah.
And then Park City has enacted a fireworks ban and an open fire burning ban. And that's because they're worried about these kinds of fires sparking. And, you know, this town has a history of fires devastating the area. I mean, it's been a while since that's happened, thank goodness. But they're taking extra precautions. And that ban is in effect until further notice, Bob. It could be in place all summer. So people are saying, what does that mean for my 4th of July fireworks? Well, it means you can't shoot them off. If you cross the line and went over into Wendover and got some fireworks, or Evanston and got some fireworks, don't shoot them off within Park City limits. And there's only been a few times that the actual official fireworks show for Park City Mountain Resort hasn't gone off. And it should be okay for this year, but, you know, we have a couple more days to go.
They were talking about the precautions that they take. They have, obviously, fire trucks out there during, that's why they can do it. They wet the ground, take the trucks and put water all over the ground, the area that they're going to be shooting those off, and take all the precautions so that there's those sparks are falling on moist ground rather than dry ground. So people are saying, well, why can they do it and I can't? Well, that's because there's about 5 fire trucks and firemen, and they take all the precautions to make sure there's not a problem with it.
So. Good point. They're ready to put it out if something starts. Just a reminder, this is Mountain Money. It is 9:37 here on Monday morning, June 26th. Renee Bodley here, the new co-host of Mountain Money, here with Bob Hendricks. We're waiting for Vanessa Chapman and Chelsea Anderson to come in studio. They're the new owners of Main Street Social. That's a new restaurant on Heber's Main Street. It's in that cute red sandstone house that's right there on the corner. I'm real eager to hear what plans they have in store for that space. Hope they show up soon. I'm trying not to take this personally, Bob. You know,
yes.
It's only my second show, and
yes.
Guests aren't showing up. That's a little scary.
We had lunch in there recently, and I noticed the walls were about 2 feet thick building that we were in. It'd be fascinating to find out the year that was built and some of the information about it. We also had talked at one point about the Chamber of Commerce having a secret shopper that went through the area. And I know you covered this when you were in the news department and some of the findings they found about Heber and that were kind of disturbing, and then some were positive. But one of them was that the signage in a lot of the businesses wasn't there, and a lot of the businesses were not open at regular business hours.
Yeah, this guy was fascinating. I'm trying to look up his name while you're talking. He did about a 3-hour presentation. It was a few months ago to the Heber Valley Chamber and their members. And his insight was extraordinary because he had been to the Heber Valley area. So this is Midway and Heber and all points in between. And he was there in the summer. And then he came back, and when he came back, it was winterish, and it was not a pretty time. It was the time where there were still leaves down and piles of snow, and he pointed out some really obvious things that when he said them, you could kind of see everybody in the room go, oh, yeah, the benches on Heber's Main Street are up against the street, not back up against the buildings. And so if you are walking down Heber's Main Street and you want to sit on one of their benches, your feet are going to be on the curb. So if there is a car parked on the curb, and they have parking on the curb there, you're sitting 2 feet away from a car as opposed to sitting on the other side of the sidewalk up against the store. And he gave examples of smaller towns. I think Leavenworth, Washington was one of them, where towns have enacted sign ordinances. There's a uniformity to their signs. There's a beautification effort on the main street, pots of flowers. And I've noticed some stores on Heber's Main Street taking that feedback to heart and doing just some simple things to make the aesthetic appeal better on Heber's Main Street. It's tough on Heber, right? You got 40 going right through Main Street, and you've got those trucks, and a bypass is probably 2 decades away. So Heber's Main Street has some challenges that aren't going to go away anytime soon.
And I understand that it's kind of a situation where I think UDOT is saying, we'll do this if you'll do this as far as the road going around. And it's a problem that's almost unsolvable at the moment.
Well, in Wasatch County, when you register your car, there's a $10 fee that goes towards the bypass fund.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a western route that they're going to build this bypass. And I'm sorry, I don't know. I want to say it starts kind of near the airport and then is going to terminate probably up near 500, 600 north. And the city has been, or the county, has been slowly buying up parcels of land using that bypass fund. So it takes a while, one, to procure the land, and then you need UDOT to work it into their planning process. But Wasatch County, one of the fastest growing counties in our country, and people are moving there by the tenfold because it's a beautiful place to live. And at some point, they're going to reach a tipping point with their traffic. It may be sooner than we think.
And I think also they've reached a tipping point in new houses and a new property because they just can't keep up with them right at the moment.
Yeah, and Midway just enacted a six-month building moratorium.
Right.
That's your neck of the woods.
Yep, it is. And so they're saying we just don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the people to take care of all these permits. We've got to stop for a few moments and kind of get caught up and be more prepared for this than we are.
And that's because they went through a whole new master plan. They had many public meetings. They invited citizens in. This happened over the last year and a half to talk about what do we want our city to look like? What kind of growth do we want? How do we need to amend the city code? So they come up with all of these new ideas. However, the city planner, Michael Hanke, is so swamped with all of the applications for new developments that he doesn't have time to work with the city council and the city attorney to implement these new plans in the city code. So you have this desire for a new code, but you don't have the time to logistically put it in place. So that's when they just kind of threw up the white flag and said, uncle, and said we need to do a six-month building moratorium for residential developments.
Well, let's see if we can get Mr. Popple on the phone again. We'll take one more shot at it. Let's go to an underwriter, and we'll be right back.
National Ability Center, a nonprofit organization, supports KPCW in the empowerment of individuals of all abilities through sport, recreation, and educational programs. Summer brings adaptive rock climbing, mountain biking, horseback riding, aquatics, camps, Paralympic sport training, and whitewater rafting in Moab. National Ability Center, recreation, innovation, possibilities. DiscoverNAC.org, 649-3991.
Support of KPCW comes from Zions Bank Concierge-Style Executive Banking Services. Zions Bank. We haven't forgotten who keeps us in business. More information available online at zionsbank.com.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. We're 16 away from 10 o'clock. 86 for a high today. And smoke in the forecast. Isn't that interesting for the next couple of days? 59 degrees currently.
You don't see that too often, do you? We've got our guest here, Bob. We have Vanessa Chapman from Main Street Social joining us now. Vanessa, we were chatting a little bit about your restaurant before you came in. We have both eaten there. I was there in December, had a lovely bowl of pho. Is that how you say it?
It's pho, yeah, or probably pho, but American pronunciation, pho.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you have on your menu and price point. Just give us the big overall look at your restaurant.
Oh, okay. Well, so basically we've got a lot of American fare, but with some European and sort of international influence. Like, you know, for example, we have a burger that we do with brisket. It's served with fries, but our seasoning blend on the fries is a Baharat seasoning blend, which is a Middle Eastern spice. It's pretty much inspired because I like to travel. My husband and I love to travel. We lived in London together. I lived in Spain. We lived in Australia, and so we like to bring all of that influence to the food that we serve at the restaurant. Our price points are reasonable because, you know, I think that everybody deserves to have a night out, to have a good meal, have a night out. So we try and keep our burgers and sandwiches at $15. And then we have some higher price items like strip steak, New York strip steak, for people who want to have something a little bit more special.
My wife does not eat beef, and she had your chicken sandwich and just absolutely loved it.
Oh.
It was very unusual, very different.
I love to hear things like that.
And when we were there, we went to the Christmas festival down at the bank building and then walked up, and you had the Christmas crackers.
Yep.
So you had the crown, the paper crowns that you can put on, and people in the room next to us were having a great time with that. We had a great time with that. The wintertime's got to be a challenge for you. It's tight in there. There's not a lot of space.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what's kind of interesting about it is that we actually love the winter. I love the winter. I mean, I love the summer as well because, so like you mentioned, we only have 30 seats inside in the winter. And, you know, it is a challenge. It's a huge challenge for restaurants to have a small seating capacity because your ability to make revenue is limited because generally people want to eat between the hours of about 6 and 8. And so we can only seat 30 people at a time. But still there's an intimacy to it. And the reason why we are so small inside is because we're in a historical building that's from 1888. And it is a beautiful, charming building in Heber that deserved to be restored and loved. And I think that the intimacy of that space is wonderful. I get to go out. I get to talk to people who come in and eat. Like you mentioned, the Christmas crackers. We've got tables speaking to each other, you know, and passing the crowns around and taking photos together. And I think that that part is wonderful. In the summer, of course, we have the patio. And then we expand to 100 seats. And, you know, it's a completely different feel, but it's frenetic, it's beautiful, it's, you know, it's outside, we have these incredible trees. It's just a really wonderful summertime space.
I noticed the windows, like 2 foot thick, 2 feet thick. Tell me about the building. How old is it? Has it been there for years?
Yeah, the building is actually originally from 1888. And it's solid stone. The stone is actually from a quarry that's local in Heber that is still active. And so you can still purchase the stone. And the way even that the building was constructed is the old way that they used to do concrete, where they mixed like sand with almost like a glue substance. And so you can literally go over and just rub the space in between the bricks and it'll almost just blow away. But the bricks are about 1 foot 2 feet thick, which the walls are as well, which has its own challenges when doing a renovation. But it also has so much character and it's so beautiful. And it allows for those beautiful windowsills that you see when you're inside the dining room. They're almost like window seats that are built into the building. I mean, it was really spectacular architecture.
And the bar area is darling. Not a lot of seats at the bar. And when we were there, we actually wanted to sit at the bar because that seems to be the primo spot to pull up a stool and then you can watch the traffic and the people going by on Main Street. Do you have any plans to expand that area? And can you talk about the challenges of Utah's liquor laws when you run a restaurant?
Well, we don't have any plans to expand the area. The bar is very beautiful, and I have to thank Kurt Russell, who did all of our iron work. It's all custom, and it's gorgeous. But we're not going to expand the space, because really if we expand the space, that would mean changing the character of the building, because we'd have to be, you know, moving walls and taking down staircases and things like that. And really my whole purpose when purchasing the building was to preserve that building and to restore its character and charm. For us personally, I mean, Utah does have its challenges when it comes to liquor laws compared to many other places. I'm originally from New York, and then I went to college in California. So two places that have very loose liquor laws in comparison. But I mean, for us, you know, I think that it depends on what you want to do. I mean, we're creating a family restaurant. We're not driven by our alcohol sales. And so it hasn't been such a challenge for us personally as business owners. I mean, we find that we fall very evenly into the split between food and liquor at the restaurant.
One more thing before we wind this up. Someone recently attended a meeting where you catered, and they were just delighted on what you served. Is that something else that you do is catering?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, originally I had a catering company called Main Street Social. And so I was catering. I was running a catering business with my husband. And we also do consulting on restaurant design and menu concept. And it was when I was running my catering business that I realized that this building that was 5 minutes from our house was for sale, that I had been in love with since we had moved to Heber. So we still do catering. I don't do as much, but it's one of my passions. So I like to try and get out there and cater when I can.
And you're in a sweet spot. I mean, the restaurant business is really subjective, right? All you need is someone to visit and maybe not like the food for whatever reason, or the service not good for whatever reason, and they're never coming back. You're in a fast-growing city, a fast-growing county. You think you got a place where you're going to stick for a long time?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, Heber is, I believe, the sixth fastest-growing city in America of its size. So there's a huge amount of opportunity there, and I urge any and all chefs who, you know, started the career off in Park City as I did and are looking for the opportunity to do their own thing to look at Heber as an option. And I think it's an incredible one. And I, for one, love working in Heber. I love living in Heber, and I love our building and the sense of community. And I see this being my home.
At a recent Planning Commission meeting in Midway, they were talking about the new Panda Express that just opened up. And there was another chain restaurant that just opened up on Main Street. And one of the planning commissioners said, can we please get some owner-operated, you know, locally owned restaurants in town? So you're fitting that bill for them.
Yay. That's what we want.
Wonderful. Vanessa Chapman with Main Street Social Restaurant in Heber, corner of Main Street and 100 South. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Deacon Haymond, head honcho at Haymond Law. In life and in death, we support KPCW. We prepare wills and trusts and provide guidance on income and estate taxes. We can also answer questions about the loss of a loved one or the loss of someone who isn't loved but must be dealt with anyway. Our office is at Kimball Junction, and more information is at deaconhaymond.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley here with my co-host Bob Hendricks. We're running a little behind time here right now. We've got a very important guest on the phone with us. Ryan Popple, the CEO of Proterra. He is the man of the week with these new electric buses that are zipping around town. Good morning. Do we have Ryan Popple on the line?
It doesn't sound like it. We must have lost him again.
Oh, shoot. We can drag Vanessa back in here and ask her some more questions about Main Street Social. Well, these buses, Bob, we have six new electric buses. And this makes this bus route Utah's first zero-emission battery electric mass transit fleet. And they're really cool-looking buses. They're bigger than most buses. They are not made of metal, unlike other electric buses that have been maybe retrofitted. They have some carbon makeup. I'm not saying the right word.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very cool. And Leslie Thatcher and I were talking before the show. She went to the ribbon cutting on Friday at 11 out at Kimball Junction, where there are a lot of our public officials, a lot of community members there, very excited about this electric bus because, as we know, Park City has a pretty ambitious goal to go to net zero by 2030. I think it's 2030.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an important step for them, and I was talking to one of their directors of development who was on Cool Science Radio, Alan Woostensko, last Thursday, and he said that this is a favorite project of Ryan's. He said Ryan won't tell you that, but this is a favorite project of his because his parents live here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in Park City. And so he comes to Park City for vacation, and when he was doing his speech on Friday, he talked about being here over the winter with his 10-year-old daughter. And he said, you know, the transit system here is great. It's free. And he got on the bus with his 10-year-old daughter. They go to the ski resort. And as they're getting off the bus, the 10-year-old looks at the bus driver and says, why isn't this an electric bus? And he said, here I am on vacation. You know, one time I don't have to think about electric buses. And here is my daughter hawking my wares for me. So it was pretty funny.
Seems to be one problem that Leslie was talking about. I think I read that they're 5 feet longer than most buses in town. And so it creates a problem getting them into some of the smaller subdivisions in Park City.
Yeah, and excuse me, these buses are designed specifically to do that express route. So they'll go from the Kimball Junction Transit Center. They will stop at Canyons, that transit center there, that loop around that 7-Eleven. Then they will stop at the Fresh Market, and then they will come in here to our transit center. So they will do only two stops, which might be slightly irritating to people who are standing at other bus stops along 224 and see that big, fast, fancy bus zip right by them. But it's an electric express. The whole idea is to make it really easy for people who need to get between Kimball Junction and Old Town and to do that as quickly as possible.
You know, we're in pretty good company when it comes to these Proterra buses. I see them in Seattle. I see them in other big cities. And so we're kind of jumping right on the bandwagon. And of course, this whole thing is to make this city just as green as possible.
And they have an interesting recharging system on these buses. So they do their loop. And when they pull back into the Kimball Junction Transit Center, that's where they recharge. And one of the things I wanted to ask Ryan is the charging's done at the top of the bus.
It falls from the ceiling and down and connects, yeah.
So when it's snowing and you got snow on top of your bus, How does that affect it?
That would be interesting to find out.
And another interesting thing about our climate here, the battery, I think, is kind of in the center of the bus, on the bottom of the bus, and really weights it down, unlike other buses where the diesel tank's in the back. And so it makes it easy to maneuver in the snow. And it's supposed to make it better driving for these electric buses, which was also good to hear.
Well, it's too bad we couldn't get Ryan on the phone today because we have so many questions. We have to try to get him back on another program.
And, you know, maybe that's best. If there's a silver lining to this, maybe we have a couple of weeks of this electric express under our belt in our community, and then we can get him on the phone and ask him some more questions about it.
I was thinking about the bus business. How many buses can you build? How, you know, and this, a number he gave us, 5,000 buses are replaced every year across the country. So there's a nice market for this if people want to go electric. There are 70,000 buses in operation in the country. Lifetime of a bus is 12 years. So, you know, when you're in the bus business, I guess there's a bright future for you, and especially when you're in the electric bus business.
Yeah, it says, this is a Forbes article, Proterra has shipped 88 electric buses to U.S. customers since 2010. I think this article was from 2016. Including 25 in the year 2016. They generated, they're estimating about $19 million in sales through November 18th, 2016, based on an average price of, get this, Bob, $750,000 per bus.
Ouch.
It's a privately held company, but I also read it's possible there may be an IPO for Proterra within the next couple of years.
Okay.
And Ryan Popple is quoted as saying he thinks that mass transit buses could be the first unit of vehicles in America that go all electric.
And speaking of all electric, batteries. And batteries go bad, and batteries are very expensive. I understand they have kind of a lease program to help you get in and out of these batteries as they become older. So they've thought of so many things that used to be negatives on these type of vehicles. I think they've overcome a lot of the objections.
They make their own batteries. And they were talking on Cool Science Radio about how they will switch out the batteries in the buses when they're at about 70% capacity. Now, again, they top off, as they call it, when they loop through that Kimball Junction Center. So every time they drive back to Kimball Junction at the end of that loop, they top off the battery so you've got a full charge. But he said when that battery has gone through only 20 or 30% of its life, Bob, I think he said when the batteries are still at 70% capacity, they will replace them. And they're looking at potentially a market for those one-off batteries. And Lynn Ware Peak, who's one of our co-hosts of Cool Science Radio, she's got solar panels on her house. And she said, hey, can you start selling them to residential solar power users so they have them to store energy for those cloudy days when their solar panels don't work, to effectively get them completely off the grid.
Isn't that interesting how we're moving from so quickly into this solar and into electric buses, electric everything anymore? You know, the Tesla, what a marvelous vehicle that is.
Yeah.
It has its limits. I notice in the winter they kind of go away, and in the summer they pop up all over Park City. So we must put them away in the winter, I suppose, because of the cost. But we're in a time now where things are moving so quickly, it's kind of hard to keep up.
You know, I've seen a lot of Teslas in the winter around here too, Bob, and there's one that looks like kind of this SUV. It's a larger Tesla. Let's get somebody from Tesla on the show.
Okay.
Let's make that a goal.
It has the back doors are gullwing doors in that particular vehicle, and it's just fascinating to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's neat. Okay, Tesla, that's our goal. Stay tuned, listeners. We hope to get that. We really apologize for not having the CEO of Proterra, Ryan Popple, on, but we will hope to get him on again soon, maybe here in person because he comes here a lot to Park City, I understand.
That would be a nice time you bring the daughter in. Bring her in, too. We'd like to talk.
From the mouths of babes,
yeah,
always
right.
Enlightening.
That's right.
I want to read this one more time. Here's a little PSA for our listeners. Summit County Council is hosting a work session and open house this week to discuss what's known as the Klein Dolly property. It's 30 acres near the Jeremy Ranch Elementary School. The county bought this land for $3.7 million. Their goal is to build a transit-oriented development. Summit County Council will discuss the parameters of this development in a work session this Wednesday from 2 to 4 in the afternoon at the Richens Building. Then there will be an open house from 4:15 to 6:30 at Jeremy Ranch Elementary School. I know a lot of people in Pine Brook.